Hello and welcome to Inside Education. We're online at insideed.com. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
Sure, you know, it's always tempting to focus on those things that we know how to measure and measure easily and well, but it's always, I think almost always more important to focus on the things that are hard to measure, because the things that are hard to measure are usually those that count the most in terms of kids' growth and development.
I'll bring you an interview with one of the most respected US experts on the teaching of reading. He was the keynote speaker at the Reading Association of Ireland's annual conference this week. But first, as always, we go to Barry Hennessy for this week's Education News. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. We begin this week with possibly the single most important issue facing all those who work with young people, and it's child protection. The Minister for Education and Skills, Rory Quinn, this week launched updated child protection procedures for schools that will come into place immediately and replace earlier procedures issued in 2001 and 2004. The purpose of these new procedures is to give clear direction and guidance to schools in implementing Children First in the school setting. All primary schools will also be required to fully implement the Stay Safe programme. In practical terms, the main new elements that schools must put in place include making a copy of the school's child protection policy available to school personnel and the Parents Association and to all parents on request. The policy must include the names of the designated liaison person and their deputy. The name of the designated liaison person must be displayed in a prominent position near the main entrance of the school. In addition to informing the school authority when a report on a child has been submitted to the HSE, the school authority must be informed also of cases where advice was sought from the HSE and no report was made. This information must be contained in the principal's report to each Board of Management meeting and recorded in the minutes. Each school must also carry out an annual review of its child protection policy and put in place an action plan for any areas for improvement identified. A record of this review must be made available to the school's patron and the Department of Education on request. In his foreword to the new guidelines, Minister Quinn says that child protection must be a priority for every school and must be at the core of all of its activities. The larger of the two second-level teaching unions, the ASTI, says it has little confidence that the necessary resources will be provided to enable the successful implementation of junior cert reforms. In a statement issued this week, the union expressed concern that the proposal for short courses as a part of the reformed curriculum would lead to social inequality, as some schools would be in a better position to fund the design, development and delivery of such courses than others. The ASTI also expressed concern that the new 8-exam subject limit is to be introduced from 2012. The union described the limit as the least thought-out aspect of the reforms and said it's dismayed that it's to be introduced first. The implementation of this proposal, the union says, will present a logistical nightmare for schools with huge uncertainty in timetabling arrangements, teacher allocations and school organisation. Individual subject classes could include students taking the subject for examination, students not taking the examination, and others who've yet to make up their minds, a combination which the ASTI says will have serious implications for classroom management. The ASTI also restated its opposition to state examination work being marked internally in schools. But it would seem that not all of its members are on side on that point. A report in the Irish Independent this week said that over 4,000 pupils in 94 schools did the optional junior cert oral Irish exam, which is run internally. The ASTI represents teachers in over 40 of the schools involved. The article quotes unnamed principals as saying that the examining work is carried out by a combination of teachers from within each school, teachers from other schools and retired teachers. The ASTI told the Irish Independent that it's aware of these ad hoc arrangements, but it doesn't support them. Promoting literacy and numeracy through teacher education was the theme of the 9th annual conference of SCOTENS, the Standing Conference on Teacher Education North and South, held in Cavan this week. The keynote speakers at the conference were Professor Teresa Nunez, Professor of Educational Studies at Oxford University, Professor Sir Bob Salisbury, formerly of the School of Education at Nottingham University, and Dr. Harold Hislop, Chief Inspector of the Department of Education and Skills. Opening the conference, the Junior Education Minister, Ciarán Cannon, said that improving children's literacy is a major issue in schools north and south, and that without these skills, our young people cannot benefit from further educational opportunities, nor can they take up meaningful and fulfilling work and social experiences in adult life. Finally, Teachers for Gender Equality is the theme of this year's World Teachers' Day, to be celebrated on Wednesday, the 5th of October. World Teachers' Day is a global initiative run by UNESCO and Education International, the World Federation of Teachers' Unions. According to the official website for the event, even though the teaching profession globally is largely made up of women, inequality remains an issue. Even if measures to ensure equality are enshrined into the policies and constitutions of many states, for millions of female teachers, these goals remain unfulfilled. If you want to keep up with World Teachers' Day this week, the website is 5oct.org. And that's this week's Education News, Sean.
Thanks to Barry for this week's news, and Barry Hennessy will of course be back at the same time next week. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, insideed.com. The Reading Association of Ireland organised their 35th annual conference this weekend. It was held in the Church of Ireland College of Education, and the theme was Creating Multiple Pathways to Powerful Literacy in Challenging Times. Their keynote speaker was Professor P. David Pearson from UC Berkeley. He began his career in education as a fifth grade teacher, and since then he has made an enormous contribution to our understanding of how students learn to read. He has served as editor of numerous books and journals and has received several awards for his contribution to research on reading. His keynote address to Irish teachers was titled The Future of Reading Comprehension, The Impact of Disciplinary Perspectives. I met up with P. David Pearson after his talk, and I began by asking him what message he wanted to leave with Irish educators when he was finished.
Well, I think the essence of my message is that it's better to think of reading, and I would add writing and oral language, particularly what we call academic language development, better to think of reading, writing, and language as tools that to help kids acquire knowledge and inquiry skills in disciplines like science, social studies, and literature and mathematics, than it is to sort of take the literacy curriculum and isolate it off in a corner in its own silo.
So is this the idea then that really every lesson can be a reading lesson?
Yes, every lesson can be a reading lesson in the sense that we want kids to be able to use reading as a tool for learning, yes.
And would you be concerned then that there could be a risk that if every lesson becomes a reading lesson, that the focus could actually move away from developing reading specific skills among children in class? Say, for example, if I'm teaching a history lesson, which I'm hoping to develop their reading skills, but I might actually just forget about the reading development when I'm focusing on the history.
Well, I think that's exactly the problem that we have right now, particularly in our secondary schools, is that because teachers of history and science don't believe that their kids have very well-developed reading skills, at least in relationship to the challenge of the text they would like them to be able to read in their classes. So instead of helping the kids develop the strategies to unlock the ideas that are in those texts, the teachers simply tell them what they would have learned had they actually been able to read or taken the time to read those texts. And ultimately, that's a counterproductive strategy, because there does come a kind of a doomsday where you know, maybe not in high school, but in secondary school, but you know, you get out on the job force or you go to university, and people actually expect you to read those texts on your own and understand them and be able to summarize what was in them. And if we aren't helping kids acquire those skills in the context of learning history or learning science, then I don't know where kids are going to develop them. I want every teacher of history, every teacher of biology, every teacher of mathematics to take it as his or her primary goal, helping kids acquire knowledge and inquiry skill in that discipline. But I also hope that they understand that those students can't gain access to mastery over that discipline unless they're competent at reading texts and writing texts in that discipline. In other words, it can't all just be taken in by osmosis through listening to them talk as lecturers in the classroom. They have to come to terms with the way texts are organized and the strategies that historians or scientists use for making sense out of their texts.
Well, one of the key areas of your own research has been in the area of comprehension. And I suppose one of the things I'd like to ask you is, how do children learn to comprehend text?
Wow. How do children learn to comprehend text? That's like asking, how do we become smarter and more knowledgeable over time? Well, first of all, comprehension can't happen unless kids actually have a lot of opportunity to read and just interact with text. Secondly, comprehension isn't going to happen without an opportunity to talk about the text you've read with others, because the conversation around that actually helps you as a reader learn what to pay attention to. Because if you and I just read the same story, let's say we just read a chapter out of Moby Dick, and we sit down and talk about it, and you say what you got out of it, and I say what I got out of it, and what you got out of it is different, that's a signal to me that I might want to look at the text in a different way. So there's sort of the informal refinement of approaches and strategies that occurs in conversation. So opportunity to read, opportunity to talk about the text that you are reading. And then the third component of it is the identification and the application of particular strategies that we want you to invoke to monitor your reading, to sort of figure out whether or not it's making sense to you. And then if it's not, to find a way to fix that up. And here's what I mean about that. You're reading along and you just read the last three pages and you say, God, you know, I can't remember a word of what I read. That's monitoring, and that tells you that you now have to do something. And then we have these reading comprehension strategies, which are really sort of little routines that we want kids to invoke in exactly the situations where they realize that there's a problem with their reading, like I don't remember a thing from the last three pages. And then teaching those strategies, and as I indicated in my presentation today, teaching them in the context of acquiring knowledge in science or social studies or mathematics is, I think, precisely what we want to do. So those components, opportunity to read, rich talk about text, and the explicit teaching of strategies within the context of acquiring knowledge in the disciplines are three critical components to acquiring it. But ultimately, what kids have to learn is that the only way you know whether you've understood something is by comparing the output of what you've read with what you already know. Knowledge is the touchstone that we all use as mature readers to figure out whether or not we've understood what we read. We ask ourselves, does that jive with what I know? And if it's different, what makes it so? And should I believe what I already know, or should I believe what was in the text?
If a teacher is teaching decoding, it's very easy for the teacher to check whether or not the child can decode after they've spent some time on it. But if a teacher is teaching for comprehension, how can a teacher know whether or not a child comprehends text?
Well, I promised to answer the question, but first let me point out that the problem that you've just identified is like the old story about the guy who was looking under a lamppost for his keys, and somebody came along and said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm looking for my keys." He said, "Well, did you drop them here?" He says, "I don't think so, but this is the only place where I can, you know, there's enough light to see if they're here." Focusing on decoding because you can measure it and not focusing on comprehension because it's hard to measure is a bit like looking under the lamppost even though there's nothing there. At any rate, back to the question of, well, sure, you know, it's always tempting to focus on those things that we know how to measure and measure easily and well, because then we can feel good about the progress we're making with kids. But it's always, I think almost always, more important to focus on the things that are hard to measure, because the things that are hard to measure are usually those that count the most in terms of kids' growth and development. And, you know, kids aren't going to get into you know, university because you taught them to decode well. They're going to get into university because you help them with the tough stuff of figuring out whether or not they're understanding what they read well enough to actually be accountable for the information in the text.
But still, it comes back to a teacher likes to be able to have, I suppose, a sense of pride in their work and to say, yeah, I actually did make a difference to those children in terms of their comprehension. How can I actually assess,
sure, okay.
How can I assess comprehension?
Sure. Well, a lot of ways to assess it, but, you know, I think asking kids open-ended questions and helping them come to realize that for many of the questions we could ask about a text, there is more than one right answer, and that the quality of your response depends upon the degree to which you've been able to use the information in the text to perform some kind of task that we would all agree represents understanding, like being able to create a good summary for the text, being able to take the information of the text and compare it with another book that you might have read or another article you might have read, being able to compare what you read in the text with what you've been learning about in class, all those kinds of things that represent more of a synthesis or more of a critique. And by critique, I mean comparing what you thought was in the text with something else that you already know about or perhaps another text you've read or the like. And then evaluating the quality of the kids' performances on the basis of what we know to be good standards of, you know, what constitutes a good summary, what constitutes a good comparison of information across two information sources. That's all a little, that all involves human judgment. But, you know, most of the important things in teaching involve some sort of judgment. That's why we think of teaching as a profession. Professions are those occupations in which we ask people to make judgments of other people often on the basis of the best knowledge that they can bring to bear. And that's, you know, even though it's harder to measure, it's what we pay teachers the big bucks for. Or I guess in Ireland we say the big euros for. Yeah.
And if we stick with that for a moment, one of the standardized tests here puts a lot of emphasis on using closed procedure as a way of testing comprehension. What do you think of, say, this is where you have gaps in the passage and the children have to fill in missing words. How good is that for testing their children's comprehension?
Well, the closed procedure has been with us since the 1950s. Your score on a closed test will always correlate with your score on a test where we ask you questions and then either have you do multiple choice responses or have you write out your responses, you know, some sort of what we call constructed response format. So they're always going to correlate. So in that sense, close is in the same ballpark as other measures. The problem with close as a measure of comprehension is that it's more an assessment of your knowledge about how language works than it is an assessment of comprehension per se. That is, on what basis do you figure out what word goes in the blank? Well, it's on your part of its content, but a part of it's like, well, this has got to be a noun here, or this has got to be an adjective here, or something like that. The most damning indictment of closed tests is research done in the 80s, by several people, but Shanahan, Camille, and Tobin did this very, very important study in which what they did is they built a closed test, and then they scrambled the order of the sentences. And it didn't make any difference whether the sentences were in the correct order or in a scrambled order. What does that tell you? That tells you that close is sensitive to the local contextual effects inside a sentence. Now, if you want to take that as an index of comprehension, fine. But I think most of us would like our index of comprehension to be sensitive to folks' understanding of the entire passage.
Okay, or the entire chapter or whatever.
Yeah.
What exactly is the relationship between decoding and comprehension?
The relationship between decoding and comprehension. First of all, let me make it clear that I'm not one of these sort of radical constructivists who thinks it's unimportant to be able to decode words accurately. I actually think accurate decoding is an essential part of reading. And just to stay with that point for a moment, often it's the really rich literary texts, poetry, for example, where we want to make sure that kids are getting the words off the page in the way the author intended the reader to get it off the page. Because otherwise, how do we capture the nuance and the sort of depth that was left there by the writer? So accurate decoding is essential. But accurate decoding, I guess I would call it a necessary but not a sufficient condition for comprehension, right? We want kids to decode accurately, but just because you decode accurately is no guarantee that you're going to be able to understand what you read. That's going to depend upon other things, like your knowledge of how language works, your content knowledge about the topic under consideration, the degree of effort that you've put into the text. It'll also depend on your purpose for reading. You're reading to get the gist of something, our standard for what constitutes comprehension is going to be different than if you're reading to study for a test. You know, my favorite example of that, there's an old story by about Woody Allen, who said, you know, I took a speed reading course, and he said it really works. Last night I sat down and I read War and Peace in an hour. It's about Russia. And the point is that if that's all we want you to do, the standard for understanding is low. But I guess the point I want to make is decoding, yes, but it's not the be-all and end-all. And I also don't believe in what some people call the simple view of reading. The simple view of reading suggests that when kids come to school, they have pretty good language comprehension, oral language comprehension, but what they don't have is knowledge of the cipher, the map from symbols to sounds. And so if you teach them that, then the simple view of reading suggests that if you have decoding plus oral language comprehension, that equals reading comprehension. And I guess the logic is that, you know, if you can decode, you can listen to yourself decode those words, and then you can apply your oral language knowledge and figure out what the text says. Well, I don't think it's quite that simple, and we know that there's a lot of clues available when you read that aren't available to you when you just listen, you know, like the structure of the text is more obvious, the punctuation, all those kinds of things. And so there are, if you will, some visual cues on the printed page that are available in reading that aren't available in listening. We also know that reading, for example, enables you to look back and revisit passages or parts of the text and the like. And so I don't buy the view that decoding plus oral language comprehension equals reading comprehension.
So if we take that then a step further, if a student has dyslexia, which means they have problems with text, how does that affect their ability to comprehend and to comprehend reading?
Sure. There's a lot of research on kids who are dyslexic, and there are many kinds of them. But the first thing to say is that when push comes to shove, dyslexic readers and just garden variety poor readers both share a common problem, and that is they don't understand what they read terribly well. The research on dyslexia suggests that decoding is a big issue, and that many kids who are dyslexic also are pretty knowledgeable about the world. And so they use their knowledge as a compensatory strategy to sort of discern what might have been in the text. And so quite often they do fairly well on certain kinds of comprehension measures where you just sort of have to get the gist. But when it comes to unpacking details that would support particular arguments for a point of view, they're not very good at that because they probably didn't get down to that level of detail in processing the text. So I know that dyslexia exists. I think it's a a real issue. I also am impressed by the research on helping dyslexic kids become better readers. And interestingly enough, you know what it entails usually? If you look at those good interventions, like the folks at the University of Kansas, Don Deschler and the like, they have done a lot of years of research on dyslexic readers, and it's sure they attend to the decoding problems that the kids have, but they also teach these kids to be very strategic readers and to use reading strategies intentionally to sort of get inside the text and to discern what facts go with what concepts and how you can learn how to synthesize all the information that's in the text. So good instruction for dyslexic kids entails some decoding, but it also entails a lot of what I described earlier that would fall under the rubric of good comprehension instruction.
Yeah, because I was wondering, would an audiobook work? But from what you said earlier, an audiobook doesn't have the advantages of text that you can look back and look forward and get a sense of text like that.
Yeah, you know, you can study a text. It's hard to study an audio recording. I mean, I guess with... Now, that's an interesting thing. As we move forward with our digital technologies and, you know, and we have much more facile access to different, you know, components of an audio recording, and maybe we'll get better at mapping the audio transcript so that we can go right to the piece we want to look at, because right now that's where the real advantage of text comes in, because I can just go find that spot where they talk about X or Y or Z. But that might change, you know, with technology.
And that was Professor P. David Pearson from UC Berkeley. He was in Ireland as a guest of the Reading Association of Ireland. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com or on iTunes. You can email us at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest, P. David Pearson, and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you.